As a girl, her father took her to the mountains once, to the Kagan, where he fished for trout with a retired English brigadier, an old colonial. She remembered the dry spice of the pine trees in the air, the valley falling vertically down to the river, and the shallow curve of a stream, an eddy with trout rising at dusk, pockmarks on the still water.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. Danielle Muinuddin is deeply familiar with the landscape of Pakistan. As a child, he lived in Lahore and spent holidays at his father's family farm in the Punjab region. Now he lives on that farm, spending part of the day overseeing its operations and part of the day writing. The child of a Pakistani father and an American mother, Muinuddin says he lives between the two cultures. But his first book, In Other Rooms, Other Wonders, Muinuddin vividly recreates the society of rural, feudal Pakistan in a series of interwoven short stories. Muinuddin read from his book at the McNally Jackson Bookstore on March 17th. The evening was sponsored by Granta Magazine to celebrate new writers. Muinuddin was joined by newcomer Justin Torres, who read from his short story Lessons, which was published in Granta's Father's issue.
Hello. I'll put this down if I can. Thank you for coming. I'll be reading you two short excerpts from this book. This is not the cover of America. This is the Indian cover, so don't look for this book. If you're looking for it, it has a strange figure on a black cover. I'll just launch into it, and then afterwards I gather Justin and I will answer questions if anybody has any. The first piece I'm going to read is from a story called Lily. Lily is a story about a sort of Islamabad party girl who has done too much drugs and slept with too many people and is now getting a little long in the tooth and is starting to consider reform. So this is the beginning of it. Lily had been to parties all week, month, endlessly, drinking, rarely having dinner. Walking back across the lawn from the bar with a glass of champagne, she stopped to look around her at the gathering party, the DJ setting up his booth, the waiters in white coats, and felt as if she were an actress in a traveling theater company, once again tonight to go through the same emotions, the same intoxications. For this evening, themed as Night of the Tsunami, her friend Mino's servants had brought in truckloads of sand to make an artificial beach beside his newly built weekend home at Simli Dam, where Mino sat holding court, sprawled on a dari by the water, leaning against a pillow. She found Mino tiresome, though he was perhaps her best friend, found the whole group of them shallow and false. She included herself in the indictment, drifting from party to party, flying out of Islu, as they called it, to Karachi, to Lahore, on the circuit in the spring weather, jet-propelled. There were only a handful of houses out at Samli Dam, an hour from Islamabad on bad roads, and all were empty, unlit, except this one. The place looked unfinished, the landscape all boulders, red clay hills, rock cliffs falling down to the lake. Oh my God, these people! Mino waved dismissively at a couple nosing off to the bar after saying hello. Did you see those two? Daddy-o and his little girl. You'd need dynamite to get him off her. Mino wore an embroidered cashmere shawl draped over his well-fleshed arm, his look finished with an extravagant diamond ear stud. A rich jewel in an Ethiop's ear, he said when asked about it. Lila, or Lily as her friends called her, sat perched on a stool, her slender legs held in her bare arms, chin on her knees, looking out at the water. Not yet 30, she was unusually pretty. Her hands and feet and small upturned nose, her high cheekbones, her lips, sharply defined and yet giving the impression of softness, as if she'd been trimmed out of soft brown velvet with fine scissors. Her hair, worn long with bangs, and skin that turned reddish brown in the sun, gave her a sleek appearance, the whole effect being that of a fastidious cat, tail wrapped around herself in repose, independent. Seriously, Mino, she said, flicking the stub of a cigarette far out into the water. You've got some real prizes on your guest list. She's about 16, and he looks like he breaks kneecaps for a living. oh, chill out. It's not like I invited them. He's probably some film producer, and she's about to be a star. Let the kid enjoy herself. That's your solution to everything, my love. You always tell me to chill out. The sun had just gone down over the distant line of the dam, leaving a pink band on the horizon. Light flashed off the waves, blown up by a slight breeze. Chip, 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 silver. The light seemed familiar. When had she been here before on a night like this? And then it came to her, a memory of an entirely different place. As a girl, her father took her to the mountains once, to the Karan, where he fished for trout with a retired English brigadier, an old colonial. She remembered the dry spice of the pine trees in the air, the valley falling vertically down to the river, and the shallow curve of a stream, an eddy with trout rising at dusk, pockmarks on the still water. That winter she had been in London for a wedding, not a close friend, but the wedding of the season, the daughter of some bureaucrat who made a crooked pile on the privatization of a steel mill and couldn't return to Pakistan because of cases against him in the National Accountability Bureau, nabbed, as they called it, almost a mark of distinction. Late at night after the Mehndi, riding through London in someone's hilarious car, she'd been in a bad accident. She woke at dawn in the hospital, severely concussed, and watched a rare snowfall from her bed, a thin drift on the sill, perceptibly gathering as the large flakes settled out of the gray first light and pressed against the window. She couldn't remember anything at first, where she was, why she was there, sleeping all through the day, until it began to come back, but change the experiences of another person. She had a dream. Flying alone in an airplane high above the clouds through an ice-blue sky, the wing caught fire, orange and flickering. Metal flew off in sheets, the machinery coming apart. A panel above her opened, crumpling back, throwing her out into the slipstream, and her parachute shook out like hair falling loose, streaming lines, then a canopy overhead. The plane spiraled away below her until it became a speck and hit the ground with a jet of flame as she drifted down alone through an enormous sky. She woke at dusk in the little hospital room, the snow falling still quietly outside. The snow still falling quietly outside as the sky grew dark in the window. So cold outside, so warm inside. For the first time, painfully, Lily got out of bed and went over to the window, the ridiculous hospital gown not hiding her nakedness. A visitor had brought candles, and now she lit one and turned off the lights. It seemed to her that the jet falling away was her past, and that she'd been forgiven, believing with all the intensity of a dream, like the intensity and purity of love in a dream. She would forgive herself for the wrongs she had done and the wrongs done to her, the pain she had caused her parents, who maintained the proprieties on her father's Burma Shell pension. Forgive herself for money she had thrown away, the men she had slept with, refusing intimacy, imagining there would be no cost. A few others blamed her, friends she had abandoned or guilelessly betrayed, friends thrown over and acquaintances treated cruelly. She might not have survived the car accident. Only her barest self had gotten through, and for a while she absolutely believed that she had been freed. She lay in the hospital bed at twilight after a day of snowfall and allowed a change to come over her, absolving herself. That's one. The other one is shorter. This one is from a story told in the first person. It's the title of the story is About a Burning Girl, and it's about a corrupt judge in the Lahore High Court, corrupt judges being very common in the Lahore High Court. And in fact, this is very topical since the judge in Pakistan has just been reinstated, the Supreme Court Chief Justice. So in any case, in this story, the judge has a servant, and the servant goes on leave, and while on leave, allegedly burns his wife to death, which is unfortunately a quite common occurrence in Pakistan. The judge's wife is very determined that this servant shouldn't be prosecuted for this, and therefore he, as you'll see, decides to send his steno, his reader, to take care of the problem. In Pakistani courts, and I presume also in courts all over the world, the guy who actually does most of the work is not the judge himself, who hangs out and drinks tea in Pakistan at least, but rather his reader, who's sort of been there forever and knows everything about the courts and so on. So This is a description of that reader. And as I say, it's shorter than the last one. And I think I mentioned it's told in the first person, obviously. So this is the judge speaking. And the reader's name is Mia Sarkar. The two steeds pulling my career rapidly forward along the treacherous road of the Pakistani judiciary are my wife and Mia Sarkar. Each is in a different sphere, absolutely matchless. My wife, you already know. Mia Sarkar deserves not merely a thumbnail, but a biography in two volumes, if it were possible to find out anything at all about him except his present rank and station. So far as I am aware, Mia Sarkar wore a cheap three-piece suit and a pair of slightly tinted spectacles of an already outmoded design on the day that he emerged from his mother's womb. When he leaves the office in the evening, exactly at 5, he doesn't turn a corner or get into a cab or a bus. He simply dematerializes. No one knows even what quarter of the city he lives in, much less his address. He drinks nothing but milk, one careful glassful each day at lunch, and because of his digestion, he eats each day only a single cheese sandwich on white untoasted bread with the crust cut off, brought to him by a boy from a tea stall. Before speaking, he clears his throat with a little hum, as if pulling his voice box up from some depth where he secretes it for safekeeping. His greatest feature, however, is his nose, a fleshy, tubular object gorged with blood, which I have always longed to squeeze, expecting him to honk like a bus. That would be a fatal act. There is nothing connected with the courts of Lahore that he has not absorbed, for knowledge in this degree of detail can only be obtained by osmosis. Everything about the private lives of the judges and of the staff, down to the lowest sweeper, is to him incidental knowledge. He knows the verdicts of the cases before they have been written, before they even have been conceived. He sees the city panoptically, simultaneously, and if he does not disclose the method and the motive and the culprit responsible for each crime, it is only because he is more powerful if he does not do so. Locked in his impenetrable bosom are all the riots and iniquities of the past and perhaps of the future, and when his mild figure steps out of the law courts of an evening and is lost in the crowds along the Mall, I am irrationally reminded of Lenin disembarking at the Finland station in 1917. He is a man of secret powers and a mover of great events. This is the bacillus my wife sent to resolve Khadim's case as she wanted it resolved. Mightier men than I fear him. Thank you.
I used to work here. All right, so this is called Lessons, and it's three kind of short pieces into one story. The first one's called We Wanted More. We wanted more. We knocked the butt ends of our forks against the table, tapped our spoons against our empty bowls. We were hungry. We wanted more volume, more riots. We turned up the knob on the TV until our ears ached with the shouts of angry men. We wanted more music on the radio. We wanted beats. We wanted rock. We wanted muscles on our skinny arms. We had bird bones, hollow and light, and we wanted more density, more weight. We were six snatching hands, six stomping feet. We were brothers, boys, three little kings locked in a feud for more. When it was cold, we fought over blankets until the cloth tore down the middle. When it was really cold, when our breath came out in frosty clouds, Manny crawled into bed with Joel and me. Body heat, he said. Body heat, we agreed. We wanted more flesh, more blood, more warmth. When we fought with weapons, boots and garage tools, snapping pliers. We grabbed at whatever was nearest and we hurled it through the air. We wanted more broken dishes, more shattered glass. We wanted more crashes. And when our pops came home, we got spankings. Our little round butt cheeks were tore up, red, raw, leather whipped. We knew there was something on the other side of pain, on the other side of the sting. Prickly heat radiated upward from our thighs and backsides. Fire consumed our brains, but we knew that there was something more, some place our pops was taking us with all this. We knew because he was meticulous, because he was precise, because he took his time. And when our father was gone, we wanted to be fathers. We hunted animals. We drudged through the muck of the creek, chasing down bullfrogs and water snakes. We plucked the baby robins from their nest. We liked to feel the beat of tiny hearts, the struggle of tiny wings. We brought their tiny animal fleeces close to ours. "Who's your daddy?" we said. Then we laughed and tossed them into a shoebox. Always more, always hungrily scratching for more. But there were times, quiet moments, when our mother was sleeping, when she hadn't slept in 2 days, and any noise, any stair creak, any shut door, any stifled laugh, any voice at all might wake her. Those still, crystal mornings when we wanted to protect her, this confused goose of a woman, this stumbler, this gusher, with her backaches and headaches and her tired, tired ways, this uprooted Brooklyn creature, this tough talker, always with tears when she tells us she loves us, her mixed-up love, her needy love, her warmth. On those mornings, when sunlight found the cracks in our blinds and laid itself down in crisp strips on our carpet, those quiet mornings, when we'd fixed ourselves oatmeal and sprawled onto our stomachs with crayons and paper, with glass marbles that we were careful not to rattle, when our mother was sleeping, when the air did not smell like sweat or breath or mold, when the air was still and light, those mornings, when silence was our secret game and our gift and our sole accomplishment, we wanted less. Less weight, less work, less noise, less father, less muscles and skin and hair. We wanted nothing, just this, just this. 2. Heritage. When we got home from school, Pops was in the kitchen cooking and listening to music and feeling fine. He whiffed the steam coming off a pot, then clapped his hands together and rubbed them briskly. His eyes were wet and sparkled with giddy life. He turned up the volume on the stereo, and it was Mambo, it was Tito Puente. "Watch out," he said, and spun, with grace, on one slippered foot, his bathrobe twirling out around him. In his fist was a glistening, greasy metal spatula, which he pumped in the air to the beat of the bongo drums. My brothers and I, the three of us, stood in the entrance to the kitchen, laughing, eager to join in, but waiting for our cue. He staked staccato steps across the linoleum to where we stood and whipped Joel and Manny onto the dance floor, grabbing their wimpy arms and jerking them behind him. Me, he took by the hands and slid between his legs, and I popped up on the other side of him. Then we wiggled around the kitchen, following behind him in a line like baby geese. We rolled our tiny clenched fists in front of us and snapped our hips to the trumpet blast. There were hot things on the stove, pork chops frying their own fat, and Spanish rice foaming up and rattling its lid. The air was thick with steam and spice and noise, and the one little window above the sink was fogged over. Pops turned the stereo even louder, so loud that if I screamed, no one would have heard me, so loud that my brothers felt very far away and hard to get to, even though they were right there in front of me. Then Pops grabbed a can of beer from the fridge, and our eyes followed the path of the can to his lips. We took in the empties stacked up on the counter behind him, then we looked at each other. Manny rolled his eyes and kept dancing, and so we got in a line and kept dancing too, except now Manny was the Papa Goose. It was him we were following. "Now shake it like you're rich," Pop shouted, his powerful voice booming out over the music. We danced on tiptoes, sticking up our noses and poking the air above us with our pinkies. "You ain't rich," Poppy said. "Now shake it like you're poor." We got low on our knees, clenched our fists, and stretched our arms out on our sides. We shook our shoulders and threw our heads back, wild and loose and free. "You ain't poor neither. Now shake it like you're white." We moved like robots, stiff and angled, not even smiling. Joel was the most convincing. I'd seen him practicing in his room sometimes. "You ain't white," Pops shouted. "Now shake it like a Puerto Rican." There was a pause as we gathered ourselves. Then we mamboed as best we could, trying to be smooth and serious and to feel the beat in our feet, and beyond the beat to feel the rhythm. Pops watched us for a while, leaning against the counter and taking long draws from his beer. "Mutts," he said, "you ain't white and you ain't Puerto Rican. Watch how a purebred dances. Watch how we dance in the ghetto." Every word was sharded over the music, so it was hard to tell if he was mad or just making fun. He danced and we tried to see what separated him from us. He pursed his lips and kept one hand on his stomach. His elbow was bent, his back was straight, but somehow there was looseness and freedom and confidence in every move. I tried to watch his feet, but something about the way they twisted and stepped over each other, Something about the line of his torso kept pulling my eyes up to his face, to his broad nose and dark, half-shut eyes, and his pursed lips, which snarled and smiled both. "This is your heritage," he said, as if from this dance we could know about his own childhood, about the flavor and grit of tenement buildings in Spanish Harlem, and projects in Red Hook, and dance halls and city parks, and about his own poppy, how he beat him, how he taught him to dance, as if we could hear Spanish in his movements, as if Puerto Rico was a man in a bathrobe, grabbing another beer from the fridge and raising it to drink, his head back, still dancing, still stepping and snapping perfectly in time. And then this is the last one. It's called The Lake. One unbearable night, in the middle of a heat wave, Pops drove us all to the lake. Ma and I didn't know how to swim, so she grabbed onto Poppy's back and I grabbed onto hers, and he took us on a little tour, spreading his arms before him and kicking his legs underneath us, our own legs trailing through the water, relaxed and still, our toes curled backward. Every once in a while, Ma would point out some happening for me to look at, a duck touching down on the water, his head pulled back on his neck, beating his wings before him, or a water bug with spindly legs that dimpled the lake's surface. "Not so far," she would say to Poppy, but he'd push on, smooth and slow, and the shore behind would stretch and thin and curve until it was a wooded crescent, impossibly dark and remote. In the middle of the lake, the water was blacker and cooler, and Pop swam right into a clump of slimy, tar-black leaves. Ma and I tried to splash the leaves away from us, but we had to keep one arm holding on, so they ended up curling around in our jetty and sticking to our ribs and thighs like leeches. Pops lifted a fistful in the air, and the leaf clump melted through the cracks in his fingers and disintegrated into speckles in the water, and cigarette-sized fish appeared and nibbled at the leaf bits. "We've come too far," Ma said. "Take us back." "Soon," Poppy said. Ma started talking about how natural it was that Pops knew how to swim. She said that no one swam in Brooklyn. The most water she ever saw in one place was when one of the men from the block would open up the Johnny pump and the water would rush and pour forth. She said that she never jumped through the spray like the other kids, too hard and mean and shocking, but instead she liked to stand further down where the sidewalk met the street and let the water pool around her ankles. "I had already been married and pushed out 3 boys before I ever stepped into anything deeper than a puddle," she said. Poppy didn't say when or where he had learned to swim, but he generally made it his business to learn everything that had to do with survival. He had all the muscles and the will, and he was on his way to becoming indestructible. "I guess it's the opposite with you, isn't it?" Ma called back to me. "You grew up with all these lakes and rivers, and you got 2 brothers that swim like a couple of goldfish in a bowl. How come you don't swim?" She asked the question as if she was meeting me for the first time, as if the circumstances of my life, my fumbling, terrifying attempts at the deep end, the one time at the public pool when I had been dragged out by the high school lifeguard and puked up pool water on the grass, 700 eyes on me, the din of screams and splashes and whistles momentarily silenced as everyone stopped to ponder my bony weakness, to stare and stare, waiting for me to cry, which I did, as if it had only now just occurred to Ma how odd it was that I was here, clinging to her and Pops, and not with my brothers, who had run into the water, dunked each other's heads down, tried to drown each other, then ran back out and disappeared into the trees. Of course, it was impossible for me to answer her, to tell the truth, to say I was scared. The only one who ever got to say that in our family was Ma, and most of the time she wasn't even scared, just too lazy to go down into the crawl space herself, or else she said it to make Pop smile, to get him to tickle and tease her or pull her close, to let him know she was only really scared of being without him. But me, I would have rather let go and slipped quietly down to the lake's black bottom than to admit fear to either one of them. But I didn't have to say anything, because Pops answered for me. "He's going to learn," he said. "You're both going to learn." And no one spoke after that for a long time. I watched the moon break into shards of light across the lake. I watched dark birds circle and caw. The wind lifted the tree branches. The pine trees tipped. I felt the lake get colder, and I smelled the dead leaves. Later, after the incident, Pops drove us home. He sat behind the wheel, still shirtless, his back and neck and even his face a crosshatch of scratches, some only deep red lines and broken skin, some already scabbing, and some still glistening with fresh blood. And I, too, was all scratched up, for she had panicked, and when he slipped away, she had clawed on top of me. Later, Pop said, "How else did you expect to learn?" And Ma, who had nearly drowned me, who had screamed and cried and dug her nails down into me, who had been more frenzied and wild than I'd ever known her to be, Ma, who was so boiling angry that she made Manny sit up front with Pops, and she had taken the middle back, wrapping her arms around us. Ma replied by reaching across me and opening the door as we sped along. I looked down and saw the pavement rushing and blurring beneath, the shoulder dropping away into a gravel pit. Ma held up, opened that door, and asked, "What? You want me to teach him how to fly? Should I teach him how to fly?" Then Pops had to pull over and calm her down. The three of us boys jumped out and walked to the edge and took out our dicks and pissed down into the ditch. "She really clawed you up like that?" Manny asked. "She tried to climb onto my head." "What kind of?" he started to say, but didn't finish. Instead, he picked up a rock and hurled that away from him as far as he could. From the car, we heard the noises of their arguing. We heard Ma saying over and over, "You let me go, you let me go." And we watched the big trailers haul past, rumbling the car and the ground underneath our feet. Manny laughed. He said, "Shit, I thought she was going to throw you out of the car." And Joe laughed too. He said, "Shit, I thought you were going to fly." When we finally returned to the car, Ma was up front again, and Pops drove with one hand on the back of her neck. He waited until the perfect moment, until we'd settled into silence and peace and we were thinking ahead to the beds waiting for us at home, and then he turned his head to the side, glancing at me over his shoulder, and asked, all curious and friendly, "So, how'd you like your first flying lesson?" And the whole car erupted in laughter. All was okay again. But the incident itself remained, and at night, in bed, I remembered how Pops had slipped away from us, how he had looked on as we flailed and struggled, how I needed to escape Ma's clutch and grip, how I let myself slide down and down, and when I opened my eyes, what I discovered there, black-green murkiness, an underwater world, terror. I sank down for a long time, disoriented and writhing, and then suddenly I was swimming, kicking my legs and spreading my arms just like Pop showed me, and rising up to the light and exploding into air, and then that first breath, sucking air all the way down into my lungs. And when I looked up, the sky had never been so vaulted, so sparkling and magnificent. I remembered the urgency in my parents' voices, Ma wrapped around Poppy once again, and both of them calling my name. I swam towards their bobbing mass, and there, under the stars, I was wanted. They had never been so happy to see me. They had never looked at me with such intensity and hope. They had never before spoken my name so softly. I remember how Ma burst into tears and Pop celebrated, shouting as if he was a mad scientist and I a marvel of his creation. He's alive. He's alive. He's alive.
This is for Danielle. I know that you spent part of your time in Boston when you were growing up there on a farmhouse, and so you speak to characters with a certain degree of intimate knowledge. But I don't sense any enmity in your writing about some of the people that might be doing, you know, nefarious things to other either employees of that kind of farm system that you describe or to the owners. Do you, now that you actually have a farm there and you work on it, do you have any of that kind of enmity, or do you just accept it as a part of the system that's been going on forever?
They say revenge is a dish best eaten cold, so I'm just waiting. No, I'm joking, obviously. No, I don't have any enmity. I mean, certainly there would be no reason to express that kind of feeling in a book. I mean, the whole point of, or I think one of the central jobs of a writer is to be empathetic and, you know, as much as possible. And being empathetic means that you can't really judge your characters, you present them. In my personal life, I obviously, you've been reading about Pakistan in the newspapers, minimizing the number of one's enemies is a highly politically desirable thing to do. So I certainly try to be a pussycat as much as possible.
I'll ask a question. Since this is a father's issue themed event, I thought I'd ask both of you to talk a little bit about your fathers and what sort of influence they had on your work, if at all, and if they've had a chance to read your work and how they either read themselves into it or don't.
My father has never read anything that I've written. He's curious, but it's available, and he could if he wanted to, and he hasn't, so I think that says something. He has a huge influence on everything that I've done so far, because I'm working on a book that's about a family, and so him being my father, I turn to him a lot. He's incredibly charming, he's incredibly complicated, and I guess it's all, I'll leave it at that.
Well, first of all, my father was a writer of sorts, but a very bad one. He literally dictated. He wrote a book of short stories, which are called novel short stories, and not the greatest title. And a book about a novel called His Highness and the Abstract, which was sort of in some way that I never understood, supposed to debunk modern art. So certainly he was a writer. But there's one character in this book who sort of resembles my father, and certainly, I mean, my diction was shaped by my father. He was a very good speaker, and certainly my work habits were influenced by him, because he was somebody who was very methodical, and certainly that was inculcated into me. And then it was because of him that I have the, you know, he was the one who encouraged me to farm. He was sort of mystified by, I wrote poetry at the time, which he didn't think of as a job, but rather as a sort of a hobby. But it was he who encouraged me to go live at this farm from which the stories come. So in that way, he influenced me.
Thank you. This question for Daniel. I read a little something about your background. I mean, you've had several different experiences. You're a well-educated lawyer. You're now a farm owner and manager, I guess very hands-on. And of course, you are a writer. You mentioned that these stories, it's about, you know, being very empathetic to these characters, which you both met in childhood as well as now manage and see around your farms and the other matters you do when you do your business. Does it affect the way you run your business, that that you write with sympathy and empathy about these characters? That's one question. Another question is, do you miss the law?
The second one is easy. No. Being a lawyer is a grind. That's the way I found it. The first question, how is my writing informed by my farming, or vice versa? Farming. For me, the way I farm, it's very useful to in the process of writing, because what I do is in the morning I meet the managers, and then I have sort of this 3 or 4 hour period where I write, and then in the afternoon I either go through the books or you know, meet with people or whatever. But as a result, I've got one of the problems that writers have, and the reason that so many writers drink, is that you can't really do it for more than a few hours a day. So you sort of finished at 11, and then the rest of the day is looming before you, and suddenly McSorley seems like a particularly warm place. And the rhythm of it is good. I mean, I'm living in this place where, you know, I'm living with the seasons and observing nature. Observing characters, obviously. Whenever you meet some wacky person, you're like, part of it is like, oh my God, I have to do business with this guy. But then the other part is definitely for a story. So in that way, it does inform it. In terms of being empathetic in some way, I think that the person who writes is the person who does everything else. You know, it's not, you're not compartmentalized.
Thank you all.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.